Hey, what's up? It's Mr. Bill. The track you're listening to right now is the result of a 35-hour tutorial series where I recorded the process of making this song from start to finish and explained myself along the way. If you're interested in learning how to make music or sharpening your craft, go to MrBillsTunes.com and check it out. Enjoy the tune.
Hey, you're listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Hey, you are listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Hey, you're 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 listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Yo, what's up? Thanks for coming on the podcast, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, definitely. I did like zero research for this podcast, so you're gonna have to be interesting for me, I think. Usually I'm able to, like, I do some research on somebody and then I'm like, all right, that's like an interesting thing that they did, and then I like ask them about that. The only thing that I have to get us started, I guess, is like, your name is Supertask, and I know that that is related to some sort of like mathematical problem or some computer programming problem. Can you describe what Supertask means and why you named yourself that?
Sure. Conceptually, it's like an infinite series of events in a finite amount of time. So there's a lot of like, just kind of like philosophical ways to look at that. And it kind of addresses the problem of time and how that's all structured. And like, so like an example of that is if I were to think about like reaching out and like touching you, for example, I can always like divide the distance between us in half forever. So it's like, if I were to go half that, if I were to do it in a course of like 2 minutes, for example, and the first minute I move halfway to you, and then we divide the rest of the time. So another 30 seconds, I move another halfway. And then 45 seconds, I move another halfway. You could theoretically do that forever and always divide the distance in half, but then, yeah, we still actually end up reaching out and touching someone. So it's just like a paradox and just like a thought experiment of a way to position our perception of time. I chose the name just, I was going to recording school at the time, and we had to like, part of our homework was to create the brand and like do all that for our music project and stuff. And I was following this YouTuber Vsauce, and he had a video on Supertasks, and I was like really into him at the time. And for whatever reason, the name just stuck with me. I thought it was super interesting. So yeah, that's why I chose that. I think it also kind of ties into music in a way. It's like music is a temporal art form, requires like a specific amount of time to like experience whatever the song is.
What a pain in the ass it would be if life actually behaved exponentially like that. Like, you went to reach out to touch somebody, and at first it was quick, and then it just slowed right the fuck down and just kept slowing down. In a way, life might be like that, though our experience is normalized to that. So we don't really question it or feel any differently than we would if it was not like that.
Sure. Yeah, lots of different experiments, though, that like kind of explore that idea. You know, like you drop a bouncy ball and it falls like half as high each time forever type thing. There's just like lots of ways to visualize or think about time that the concept of like Supertask just like makes that. It just explores it in a different way that we're not used to thinking about time.
Mm. One thing that's kind of like racked my brain recently is how small of a subset music is in the complete set of noise. So if you look at all noise as, you know, noise is what it is, what music is in noise is such a small component of all noise. Like, for instance, to a computer, you could put in like 1,000 different white noise files, and the computer would identify each 1,000 of those as a completely different song, basically, or completely different information that it can define between, you know, like you could say, I'll pick that one and it would be able to pick it. Whereas, like, to a human, if you played us 1,000 different white noise files, and then I was like, cool, do you remember what the one, like, 300 sounded like? You'd be like, no, they all just sounded like white noise. Whereas, like, with music, you've listened to probably thousands of songs, and you remember specific ones and what they sound like. And that's kind of how the thing that made me start thinking this was how AI works in audio. It basically like puts a little bit of white noise into the file and then is able to find its way back from there, like using, you know, Gaussian blurring and denoising and stuff. And I thought that was really interesting, just the fact that music in the entire subset of noise is just so incredibly easy for an AI because of how good it is at determining different types of noise, basically.
Yeah, and I think like ultimately probably further like pattern recognition in general. It's just that's kind of like what it's equipped to do. And I think like taking, you know, if you took a 5-minute piece of time and you said like create audio within that 5 minutes, there is a finite amount of like configurations available within that 5-minute space, right? It's like you have the way that digital audio is recreated and bit depth and sample rate. It's like multiplying those things gives you kind of like the possibilities within that 5-minute space. And so it's like musically there is like a finite amount of configurations available, but then noise, like by definition, is kind of just randomness, like random voltages essentially. So AI, I think, would be better equipped at, you know, recognizing a specific noise file from a different one because there's not enough maybe like patternistic elements to it that the human brain is capable of understanding or recognizing.
Yeah, it's kind of insane. Like you said, there is a finite number of possibilities that noise can be in a certain amount of time. But like, let's take one sample, for instance, which is one like 44,000th of a second if you're at 44.1K sample rate. Let's say if you're at 16-bit, the possibilities for that one sample is something in the millions. Like it can be millions of different possible volumes at 16-bit. At 24-bit, it goes up to a few million, and at 32-bit, it goes up exponentially by like a ton. So if you just add one more sample to that, so 22,000th of a second, then you have two samples that can both be millions of different volumes. So the different combinations there would already be insane if you were to have like both at zero, both at one, both at two, et cetera, for a million times, and then offset by one in each direction by a million times, and so on. So like the finite combinations that do exist within a 5-minute piece of audio, assuming it's like 16-bit and at 44.1K, is like such a just fucking inordinately huge number. But I guess it does some sort of interpolation to round out the edges and figure out what is not useful, especially in music, right? Because like there's so many things that are not useful when the goal is to create music. Like 99% of noise is not useful is what it learns, I guess, when being taught to make music.
Well, it's like signal to noise ratio in general, I think, is kind of like up to what you really want, like what you're perceiving as signal in the circumstance. Like music, it's such an interesting thing because it's like what actually classifies as music as opposed to just noise, for example. And then like what would be actually pleasurable to listen to? Like there's even like a smaller number of finite examples of things that would actually be interesting to listen to or emotive, for example.
Do you think humans' resolution is better with color or with sound?
I think with color. And I think that would just be a guess. And I would speculate because, you know, visual, like sight is higher up in the electromagnetic spectrum, for example. It's like green light is like 532 nanometers. And I think like there's a, you know, red light, green light, there's like a huge difference in wavelength between those two waves. And I think sound, for example, you know, you have like C0 at 30 hertz or 32 hertz or whatever, then at one octave up is 64 hertz. So maybe our perception is like not as good in the domain of audio, just because like the difference between vibrations is smaller at that scale. And maybe like visually it's, you know, you have a significant difference in wavelength like at that scale. But I think this kind of ties back to just the nature of like infinity. It's like there's an infinite amount of, you know, difference between 30 hertz and 31 hertz. You could do 30.5, 30.51, 30.5111, like forever. So like, I think maybe color, you know, we probably perceive, I don't even know, but it's billions for sure. Cameras, even at like 10 bit, is like billions of colors. So it's like maybe there's a more meaningful amount of perception related to sight than audio, but I'm not sure. It's interesting.
I think our resolution is better with audio because, and this even happens in audio, right? Like if you're in the lower end of the spectrum, like you were talking about, and you have something at 30 hertz and then you move it to 32 hertz, we register it in our brain as a completely different note. Or maybe not at that low, but like, let's say, you know, like, I don't know.
Higher up, the easier.
Yeah. Well, kind of to a degree, right? There's like at a point where it starts getting harder because like at say 200 and 250 hertz, they're two completely different notes. But if you take that same 50 hertz range and you put it at like 10 kilohertz and then 10 kilohertz plus another 50 hertz, it just sounds like high frequencies to us. It's the exact same. And so in that regard with color, I think if you take, you know, a red or whatever, it's like some, you know, billion hertz or whatever it is, and then you like change the hue by 50, it's still going to look like the exact same red to us, I think. Whereas in music, when you go low enough, that 50 hertz can make a big difference. So I feel like our resolution might be better in the lower frequencies. And I think like EQs, the way they're designed is kind of mimics that idea. Like if you look at an EQ, it's usually broken up into into thirds, where like the bottom half or the bottom third is like 0 to whatever, 200 hertz, I think it is. And then from like 200 to 2K, is like a third of the EQ, and then from 2K to 20K is like a third of the EQ. And I think it's designed that way because that's just kind of how we hear, like our resolution gets shittier as we go up.
Yeah, like the equal loudness contour and like the Fletcher Munson stuff where it's like we have the acuity at like 1 to like 4K in there because of the intelligibility side of like the human voice, right? It's like there's certainly like a large, at least like the human ear seems to be tuned, if you will, or very sensitive to like the intelligibility of the human voice.
Right, which plays into like what useful music, what good, you know, enjoyable music is. It's probably based a lot around the human voice, right? Like I guess, yeah, I'm very curious as to like what it was that caused us to evolve to be like, this music sounds generally good to everybody and this music sounds generally complex and bad to everybody. Like for instance, we mostly like stuff that's 4/4. We don't like, you know, some people obviously like polyrhythmic, like weird time signature stuff, but generally we all like these more common time signatures. And in terms of scaling, like musical scales, we like, you know, 12 notes is what we break it up into a chromatic scale, and then we just like 7 of those at a time. We don't like any more than that usually.
How much of that do you think is like culturally based? Like other cultures, for example, that have different temperaments or ratios and scales and time signatures. It's like, are they brought, when they, you know, are brought up listening to it, it's like ingrained in them. Does that feel more natural? Or do you think there's something more objective about like 4/4 in our chromatic scale?
I do think there's like some level of exposure to something that will make you more tolerant of it. That's definitely true. But I think even in those other cultures with like microtonal scales and like ragas and stuff like this, I still feel like that's only maybe like half a degree different from what Western music is anyway. And it's still like all such a very small subset of just all noise.
It's weird, like I've seen the experiments where, you know, like people are like, for example, like a performer's on stage and he's like standing in one position, gets the crowd to like hum a note, and then he jumps to the left and the right, and like the crowd is able to like in unison go up and down scale degrees, like inherently. I always thought that was super weird.
Was this like Jacob Collier?
I've seen a few people do it, but I've definitely seen him do it as well. And he'll get like the crowd. He'll just raise his hand and lower his hand, and the crowd will in unison go up and down together. And I find that's very strange that there's like this inherent understanding or ability to like adapt to music.
Mm. Well, I mean, I guess we all sort of do that at a young age in school. Like, I don't know about everybody, but definitely at my school, we would do, you know, like clap-alongs and singing and shit like that. I do feel like in Eastern music, though, they're still working very heavily within the tolerances of what is useful to the human ear and the human brain. And they just, I think, push it a slight bit further. It's like instead of worrying about, you know, 7 notes in a scale, they just worry about a few more, like 30 notes in a scale or something like that, which to us, in one sense, you can look at it as like, wow, that's way more notes. That's insane. But you can also look at it as like, well, if you, like you said, take the infinite possibilities between them, it's also just like not even a difference.
Yeah, there's like also the subtle, you know, way that like 2 intervals, for example, like rub and what that feels like to listen to. And I think like the more options you have of ratios or intervals within like a scale, like the more opportunity you potentially have to like get different ways those things rub together and create different emotions from that.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Do you mess around with microtonal stuff much or ever?
When I was a little younger, I was kind of started to like study the 432 thing and just like, you know, synchronicities or whatever between like those ratios or whatever, and just like universal things, but not as much. It never really felt good to me. Like what feels personally the best to me is like minor scales at 4/4. So just what feels good to me.
Yeah, right. Can you explain the 432 theory for those who don't know what you're talking about?
Yeah, probably really poorly, but I can try. It's kind of like if you take middle A, which is in like today tuned to 440 hertz, 440 cycles per second, and you take that down to 432 as like the center, if you will. And then there's like a difference in temperament, like Western music temperament has like ratios between each scale degree. And so there's like an adjustment there as well to like do it properly. But if you were to do both of those things, the theory I think is that it coincides more with like natural measurements of the universe. Like if I remember correctly, it like makes the C's hit all of like the computer intervals. So like 32, 64, 128, 256, et cetera, like forever. And I think there was like something where it lined up with like the distance or like the circumference of the moon or like something like that. It was just like some weird little universal synchronicity or like sync up thing, but never really got too far into it. I considered much of that to be like pseudoscience and
yeah, I agree. It's pretty pseudoscientific. And I've tried it as well. I've like tried messing around with like Pythagorean tunings and stuff like that. And they sound cool. I think they sound cool because to me, they sound like Aphex Twin, you know, because he writes a lot of his stuff in microtonal music. So every time I do it, I'm like, oh, wow, that's a fucking Aphex Twin sounding thing. So I like it for that reason. And I feel like it has kind of like this nostalgic feel to it. And I feel like the reason that is because it sounds a little dissonant and a little out of tune, and that kind of sounds like a VHS tape to me. It's like a little bent. It's not perfect, whereas so it sounds like, I guess, in a way more analog and less rigid like a maybe normal scale would. But there's a lot of people on YouTube who will be like, here, Nirvana song in 432 hertz or whatever, and literally all they're doing is tuning the wave file down by 8 cents. So there's still an equal temperament tuning in between all of the notes, and equal temperament for those who don't know means that we just take, I believe, a scale and just break it up into equal parts, right? Like every note is like an equal interval or ratio from the last one. So let's say, for instance, you have one note and then a gap of one and then another note and then a gap of one and then another note. So that would be equal temperament. And non-equal temperament, like whatever microtonal tunings, would be like you have one note and then there's a gap of one and then another note and then a gap of like, I don't know, 0.96 and then another node, and then a gap of like 0.71 and then another node. So it's like all sort of every node is detuned by a different amount in a way. And I always see these people in the comment sections of those videos being like, wow, it just sounds like so much warmer and nicer. And it's like, well, yeah, of course it does. It's lower in pitch. You just tuned it down by 8 cents. It's just going to sound thicker and warmer. That's what low frequencies do. So yeah, I don't know how much I play into that. I watched this Adam Neely video on it, and he made a good point. He was like, the entire thing is based on a farce anyway, because the whole thing is based on cycles per second frequency, right? Like 432 is a it just means 432 times per second, and 440 hertz just means 440 times per second. But the whole thing is based on seconds, and we misrepresent seconds anyway. Like we represent a second as a division of a minute, which is a division of an hour, which is a division of a day. And the day is incorrect. Like the day is not exactly 24 hours anyway. It's like 23.9 something hours, which is why we have to have like an extra day every few years to catch up or whatever. And yeah, so that was a pretty good point, I think.
Yeah, like looking, I saw something about that a long time ago where there's like a specific amount of like weeks missing from the calendar back in like the 1400s or something, because they realized that like the day wasn't exactly 24 hours. And so I think they like skipped like 3 weeks in the calendar. I forget exactly when that happened, but it's in like most digital calendars. You can go see it.
Oh, really? Like even in Google Calendar? You can just scroll back to the 1400s.
I think it's like in the 1400s. It was like some religious thing where they're like, okay, no, we realized this, so we're off roughly by like 18 days or something. So they literally just skip it.
Wonder how they realized. They were just like, it's getting warmer too quick or something. Or it's cold now. It shouldn't be cold now.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by just how time was even kept, like, as accurately as it was back then. I mean, now it's like atomic clocks are probably the thing. So it's like without that technology, like how would you get, you know, as close or as close as they did?
Man, I was listening to this podcast that fucking fucked me up for a few days, a couple of days ago. It's this Lex Fridman podcast, and he was chatting with this woman who studies nuclear weapons. And she was saying, if like any other world leader sends a nuke, there's these satellites in space that can see the like the fire trail or whatever out the back of the nuke, and it sends messages directly to the commander in chief or the president or somebody, who then has to tell the president, hey, there's a nuke on the way, it's going to be here in 6 minutes, you have 6 minutes to decide what to do. And so the president would then have 6 minutes to decide whether or not to essentially accept defeat and be like, oh fuck, like we're fucked, or he could shoot a nuke back and they would be able to do this in time too and then obliterate just all of humanity. So it's like, do you want to get hit with a nuke and then just obliterate half humanity and just take this like big L, or do you want to shoot back and basically essentially definitely destroy all of humanity? Such a crazy massive decision to have to make in 6 minutes. I mean, I think he's probably thinking about it all the time, probably just has his answer ready to go. But yeah, that's fucking scary, man, that nukes just even exist, and that if you shoot one, it just like turns the world into a giant winter and everything just ends. And it's, yeah, not good.
I've always been curious about how, like, which will win the race, like artificial intelligence being able to like predict accurately and like stop these events, or like will that technology beat like the nukes from actually just like wiping out everyone? I think it's like the Fermi paradox or whatever. It's like, I feel like we're so close to AGI and so close to like all of these technological advances that are just completely unprecedented. And I hope that we don't, but I fear that we will wipe out we'll just commit suicide effectively, like before we even get to that point. But I do think we're close to like AGI and like all of that stuff. And it'll be interesting to see like how that plays into like global politics, and like, will it be able to predict somebody doing that, for example?
Yeah, the thing that made me think of this in the first place was that you said you like impressed by how people used to be able to keep time and stuff. And one thing that obviously is not known for sure, but that I think sometimes is that we just had like a pretty good society back in the day that was, you know, almost where we are today, if not where we are today or further, that just nuked each other and just ended up in back to square one, basically.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of, you know, evidence of, like, civilization, like, many times, like, you know, there's, like, lots of remnants of things, like, that we've discovered, I think, that kind of, like, you know, give us clues that humans have, like, been technologically advanced in the past and gone away and come back. And I feel like we're kind of potentially at one of those, like, pivotal moments.
Right. Do you believe in simulation theory?
I try to not be like an ideologue as much as possible, but I think that if any explanation makes sense for what we're experiencing, I think it's probably that. I think that it's the most probable that we are currently inside a simulation for sure.
Yeah, I think the chances that we're in a simulation is either like trillions to one or 50-50. And my theory there is that we're either, well, it's not really my theory, I heard it somewhere, but I agree with it, that either we're at the very end of the chain and we're just getting to making AGI and, you know, programs that are possible to build like a reality. So we're either the first one who has just not quite done that yet, and that means we're the real reality, or we're at the very end of the chain, like, you know, thousands of simulations down, who just has not quite gotten to there yet.
Yeah, I think the odds that we're in base reality, if this is like true, is for all practical purposes, zero. Like, I think that it would not make sense that we would be in base reality, to me. And I think that it's kind of like deja vu or something like that. It's like when you get deja vu, maybe that's something related to the computer, like reprocessing stuff or like something like that. But I have this like visceral feeling, if you will, that this is probably simulated.
Yeah. And there's like a lot of other things that could be looked at as clues as well, right? Like, why is the speed of light the, you know, as fast as we can go? Why is the speed of sound as fast as we can go? Like, why isn't it just infinite? Why does stuff only get so small and only so big? Like, why aren't they infinite? And
yeah, like there seem to be like physical, like physics and like parameters and like a rule set that like exists in this reality. And it's like, I guess I always just wonder, like, if this isn't simulated, like how did these rules like become established?
Yeah, kind of sus. So what have you been working on? What's exciting you in the music world lately, or what's exciting you in general? You got any like side hobbies, or is like music the thing you mostly spend your time on, or what's going on?
Music. I definitely spend a lot of my time doing music. When I started kind of like entering the creative space, I was more focused on filmmaking and like cinematography and stuff. It's kind of like where I started out as a kid. And so I still have like a deep passion for that kind of stuff, like visual art and just filmmaking and all of that. Lately I've been getting really into like Unreal Engine and like learning about that kind of stuff and like more 3D stuff and kind of combining that with the music. Musically, I've been into like scripted looping a lot. And I know we like chatted briefly about that, but just kind of like the idea of like predetermined events happening and then kind of like improvising things like into like a rule or into some kind of like time-based event. So I've been trying to like work on that. And then in culmination with that, like visually, like incorporating Unreal Engine or incorporating like visual stuff and triggering visuals like at the same time as that to kind of tell a larger story or like a more full sensory experience, if you will.
Damn, yeah, that's sick. Can you describe scripted looping to people who don't know what that is?
Sure. So I'm using a Max for Live device in Ableton by this guy named Bink Beats. He's like a phenomenal live musician. Pretty much like what happens is you're queuing, you have different like audio tracks in Ableton. So you have like a pretty much a track that's like set to do the loop. And then there's a track that's set to like do the effects or the sequencing or like the on and off muting or chain selectors or whatever it is. And so pretty much like you have scenes in Ableton and then you have tracks that are tapping like different inputs. So whether that's like a microphone, a synthesizer, a MIDI instrument, like a drum pad, whatever it is, you're triggering these loops to occur at like specific time intervals and then effects to occur at specific time intervals. And then you're just improvising the part and then going through different scenes to like move on or loop a section or repeat a section. So it's pretty much like recreating a song where the part is like played in at a specific time and then everything else is predetermined, but the part that you play in can like change every time you do perform the piece, for example. So like you could play it 50 times and have 50 different outcomes, but the effects and all of that and the mutes and on and offs and all of that trigger at the same time every time you run it back.
Are you doing this with, like, you'll write a track, like, so when you're playing a set, you're doing this, but are you still playing tracks that you've written in the set, or are you making new music specifically in this way that's designed to be played this way?
So I haven't done it live at all yet. It's, like, still just in the studio, just messing around. And I feel like, you know, I've been making electronic music now for about 19, coming up on 19 years. So I'm kind of bored of just like sitting at the mouse and the keyboard. It kind of like becomes drastically uninspiring. And so like this way of approaching it where you kind of like set this like time situation and playing in the part, at least for me, has like lately been able to kind of like unlock some new ways of creating music. And I think like for me, this is not something that I'm like taking a produced song and then reverse engineering yet, maybe in the future, but right now this is like a way for me of like writing new music.
Yeah, I always like I've tried to do quote unquote live electronic music sets a few times before, and I always felt like taking a track that was already written and trying to make it something that can be performed live was just such a, I don't know, like futile task, and just it would just kind of make the song worse. And at the end of the day, whenever I did it, it didn't make the show better. Like mostly people in the audience couldn't never like, and you could never expect them to understand that, oh, this thing's turning off at this time and then he's pressing this button to like trigger the thing instead of it just doing it automatically and like all this kind of shit and like sending signals all over the place and using complex Max devices and stuff. And I feel like I ended up coming to the conclusion that the only way to really do this like live electronic music in a way that would make sense is essentially build an instrument that can be kind of played and improvised on live that would make the music live versus trying to take already finished songs and make them performable. Just make like an environment that makes making music kind of immediate.
Yeah, I've definitely come to the same conclusion. I think that when you perform live, there's like, you know, there's so many variables and like things that are going on. There's like the social dynamic of like you as the performer, there's like the attendant like having their experience, there's like a bunch of stuff. And I think ultimately when you perform stuff, at least for me, like the objective is to give the person on the other side of the speakers or the other side of the sound system the best experience possible. And for me, that's like the recorded produced version is the cleanest, it's like sounds the best, it's the best mixed, etc. So like I think there's this thing as a performer, there's like the ego of like I want to be doing this or I want to be seen doing this or whatever it is. But ultimately I think that taking that back to just the experience of the person on the other side of the sound system and making that as good and as like novel for them as possible. Live performance has a way of, at least in like the electronic space, like subtracting from that experience.
Yeah, I think the way that the ego manifested for me in terms of wanting to do stuff was that I just got bored on stage, and I'd be like, oh, I feel awkward on stage being bored, and I feel like a phony imposter not doing anything and all this kind of stuff. So that's why I like built out these things so I wouldn't have that feeling on stage. But after doing it, I still had that feeling on stage anyway. So I was just like, meh. And I feel like that's probably the ego. It's like, oh, I feel this, I feel that. It's like, who gives a fuck how you feel? Just go play your music and don't worry about it.
Well, I mean, the reality is, like, you know, most of the work or most of like the, you know, the actual technical merit or, you know, musical merit of this is done behind the scenes in your room, like on your computer. And then when you go to perform it, you're most of the time just literally playing the file back. There's like very little effort required to DJ stuff. And I think, like, you know, it's to each their own, but I think that's often like exacerbated or kind of like exaggerated what needs to happen to like get the thing to perform live in a DJ setting. And yeah, I think there's some level of like ego there. And I don't know, for me, it's definitely manifested itself before. I've seen that before in myself. And I think like lately I've tried to just kind of chill out, and there is like the imposter syndrome of like, I shouldn't be up. Like, it just feels weird to be on stage to me. And it feels weird to like only be hitting the play button every 2 minutes and then like mixing it. I feel like I'm not reaching my potential or whatever. But given that you've like tried to do the live thing and still felt that, what do you think that is?
I guess like it might have just been the way I did the live thing, because like I was in bands before that playing guitar on stage and stuff, and I didn't feel it then. I think the reason I felt it when I did the live electronic music thing is because I didn't actually solve the problem, which is I wanted to be creating things in real time. Whereas the way that I did it, I wasn't necessarily creating things in real time. I was still just playing a game of like Dance Dance Revolution kind of, you know, just hitting the buttons at the right time. So it wasn't so much a performance, so much as just more buttons to push. And I feel like when I DJ, it's like I push a button 50 times in a set. Whereas when I was doing the live set, I was just pushing the buttons 500 times in a set. So it's like I wasn't really doing anything new, just more button pushes. So it didn't really solve the problem. And I feel like in a way you could, if you want to be like really reductive, you could kind of say like somebody playing a guitar on stage like I was back in the day is just pushing the buttons 5,000 times in a set. You know, obviously there's more articulation to an instrument like a guitar versus just a controller that sends a message to a computer to turn on or off a thing, whether it be audio or parameter or... so yeah, I think that's why.
So like, we're pretty much just talking about like input devices, like a guitar is effectively just an input device, or a MIDI controller is just an input device. And there seems to be like a level of like expression, like a varying degree of expression in like all of these different, you know, input devices. So like they started doing like MPE and like all of that stuff now, and which is like more expressive than just a typical velocity sensitive drum pad or whatever. And I think like coming back to AGI and like AI and stuff, like I wonder how that will impact input devices. Like once we get to the, you know, pinnacle of like data processing, it's like, is the input device just going to be your brain at some level? And would that, do you think, subtract from expression or add to it?
Yeah, and then on top of that, who would then become the best musicians? Would it be philosophers because they can like bend their brains in the weirdest ways? Or would it be people on drugs because their brains are like, you know, they're unlocking like different areas of their brain that aren't normally there when you're sober? Or is it going to be you know, autistic people? Maybe they would, you know, it's going to be interesting to see who, if that were the case, yeah, who would then sort of take the place of being the quote-unquote like best or most expressive. And I think that that happened once already, right, in the MIDI controller world. Like, basically the people who got the biggest benefit out of it were keyboard players, because most of the MIDI controllers that have the most expression are either keyboards or maybe drum pads, but more so I think pianos. So, you know, if you're asking this question before any input devices had been created, and we're still just in the musician aspect of music, like live musician, instrumentalist, I guess is a better word for it, phase of music, then the answer would be piano player. So yeah, I'm just curious, like, if it becomes the brain, what would the piano player be like for that next thing?
Yeah, like if we have, like, for example, Neuralink implant or something as like a wireless MIDI controller or something, and like, do you have to still have musical knowledge, or do you just have to think like what you're feeling, and then that translates to musical ideas, or like, how does that work? Because I think, like, ultimately, like, a knowledgeable keyboard player is effectively just like translating emotions with specific hand movements or patterns or whatever it is. And yeah, it's super interesting. Like, would a philosopher be a good musician just because of the way that they're thinking about stuff, or is there some level of like musical knowledge that would still be necessary if the brain was an input device?
Yeah, I'm also curious what the data transfer would look like. So you get like data coming in, say from a MIDI controller, and then there has to be like a parsing of that data that says, take this message and attach it to this thing with this range, and then take this next message and attach it to this other thing with this different range. And obviously the same would be true, I guess, of a input device through with your brain. It would be like, okay, when this brainwave happens or when this electrical activity happens, send the data through this scaling and send it to this thing, and so on. And so I guess the answer would be, it would really depend on that and how the data was being passed, what it was being attached to, what strengths and what kind of mental strengths would be an advantage there or not, and how would you even like begin to start building this thing? Like, you would have to do maybe some testing on like a lot of people to find like what the most average or the median of like different electrical activity and brain activity is, and figure out what to attach those things to. That's all assuming computing is working the same way that it does now. I guess like with AI, you could take that data, send it into an AI and just be like, you know what to do, and it would just figure it out, and it's just a black box and we have no idea how it works.
Yeah, and then also just like coming back to AI again, like the idea of like predictability of like how predictive a human is. Like, do you have control over these impulses, or do we get to the point where we realize it's like completely deterministic? Like, I feel like that is also kind of where we're headed, maybe getting some answers on this stuff with AI. And I think it's tending towards determinism.
Mm. Have you messed around with AI very much recently? And if you have, like, in what ways? What are you using it for?
So one of my friends got me into it quite a bit ago. We were doing, like, you know, Ubuntu and, like, all of that shit, and just, like, doing it locally. Like, we were learning how to just, like, set one up in Python and, like, all of that stuff. And the first thing we did, I think, was Deep Dream, and, like, trying our hand at that stuff, and like style transfers and style GANs and all of that. Lately I've kind of like migrated pretty much exclusively to like ChatGPT and things like that. There's a plugin for Ableton, plugin suite called Orb. Have you messed with that one?
Mm-mm. No.
So it's
it
like,
do?
It's pretty much like four, MIDI generators. So it has like, you have like a chord one, you have ARP, lead, and bass, and so you put them on four MIDI tracks, and then the chord one is kind of like your main interface. And so effectively, like, you can choose things like complexity, probability, you can set like note duration parameters. Like, you pretty much like give it a set of parameters for how complex or interesting or intelligent like you want the chord progression to be. And then from there, it will generate MIDI for the chord progression, like the ARP thing, the lead sound, and the bass sound. So it pretty much like generates MIDI based on like a set of parameters. So I've been using that in combination with like ChatGPT for like lyrics. So like I'll give it a circumstance or a scenario and have it like pump out lyrics. And it's actually like it's pretty effective at like rhyming. If you give it like rhyme schemes, for example, or certain things like that, it's pretty effective at doing that. And so I've been using that kind of like in tandem with the orb stuff or like emergent drums even, or things like that, to kind of just like get off of the blank canvas, like just to put something on the screen and then interacting with that after the fact, like once it's there, like changing it to your needs or how you're feeling or whatever. But so it's just a good way for me, at least lately, to like kind of get off of the blank slate and put something there that I can interact with. I think like the absence of limitation is the enemy of art, and like looking at this blank thing is daunting and hard to overcome.
Yeah, you can sometimes get like option paralysis about the blank slate. Like, fuck, where do I begin? Yeah, I've been using ChatGPT a little lately for various things too. I have the paid one of ChatGPT 4, which I think is like $20 a month, and man, it's so fucking worth it. Like, one thing I've done is you can just like put files into it and ask it stuff about the files. So if there's like some chord progression I'm working on, I'll just screenshot it and give it the screenshot and be like, what are these chords, and like what other chords would maybe go well with this? What scale is this in? Like, ask it questions about it, and it'll be like, oh, this looks like a piano roll. These notes are this, and you could do this or that, and it would give me like good information about it. Another thing I've used it for is if I'm messing around with a like complicated plugin, like the last one I think I did this with was Multiplicity by DMG Audio, which is like this really complicated multiband processor. And I was like, huh, what's this knob do? What's that knob do? So I just took the manual and just fed it into ChatGPT and just started asking it questions about the plugin. And it was able to tell me like what they did in like very simplistic terms. And the other thing I've done with it is literally put an audio file into it. And I think I put like a master into it. And I was like, here's a song I just mastered. Can you take a look at it and tell me how close it is to like other masters in the EDM genre, and like how much off am I, and what could I possibly do to make it better? And it did give me a couple of a bit of information about a bit. That one wasn't super useful. The most useful thing has been putting manuals into it and asking it questions about plugins, because it can just like read instantly. It's so much quicker than looking at the manual yourself and trying to find what you need that way.
Yeah, I've done that kind of like logic with like contracts or something. Excuse me. Like throw a contract in there and just be like, okay, what's the fine print? Or like elaborate on this term or whatever. So it's like, it's super good for that kind of stuff. Certainly for a manual, it's a good way to approach it. And I think like it does currently certainly like fall short on the creative side. And I think that kind of like, I don't know, it speaks to the separation of like humans and machines and what creative force is or whatever. And I think currently it falls short. I think it will probably get there in terms of like actually being fully useful as like a creative mechanism. But yeah, I've done the same kind of thing with like I dropped in an acapella, for example, and I was like, chop out this word, and it would just like take the word and play it back, or like half speed, like to make it slower or whatever. And it's very capable at doing that. I haven't seen it be super reliable at doing stuff like that yet, especially with like the file size limitations and just like what it can process. But I think like ChatGPT-5 is supposed to be exponentially larger.
Do you think that it's actually worse at creativity, or do you think that because creativity is subjective, that you may just see it as less creative, but in fact it's like, like, what is the objective definition of creativity in your opinion?
I don't think there probably is like an objective, like Webster's definition of it. To me, I think when something feels creative to me, it's like an exploitation of something that's naturally occurring. It's like in some way you're like exploiting something that already exists.
Right. Yeah. Like innovative, kind of like taking something and using it in like a way it was not necessarily supposed to be used, or in a new way.
Yeah, I think it's like hypothesis, like looking at this from like the apathetic negative. It's like, again, the absence of limitation is the enemy of art. And I think like, so therefore, like creativity, like naturally requires some form of limitation or some boundary to break or something to cross.
Yeah, I agree. But so if you take that definition, I think it's questionable if ChatGPT is creative or not. But if you take the definition of just like able to be, just able to create things and able to like output, you know, something at will, then it's kind of the most creative. If you're able to be like, hey, make me lyrics, and it's just like, here you go, here's like 400 options. Like, in a way, that's like the most creative, right? Because for a human to be able to sit there and output 400 songs of lyrics would take months, and it would probably rack their brain a lot.
I always struggle too with like the kind of like, are we creating the song or are we discovering it? It's like, if information, if all we're doing like in as music producers is effectively creating a sum, like an audio sum, a specific pattern of voltages that are being sent to a speaker, it's like, are we really creating like that, or are we encountering it or discovering it? I don't really believe in like intellectual property. I think that a property like requires scarcity, and I think that intellectual property is like, you can copy and paste a file forever, and I don't think there's really any legitimate like claim of ownership. So like, creativity I always struggle with in general, because it's just like, am I creating this thing or am I just like stumbling on it?
Yeah, it's kind of bullshit that you can just like mash your hand on a piano and be like, I found that set of notes, and then like copyright it. And then if anybody else accidentally does that same hand mash, you can sue them.
I think there was some two researchers or something. I looked into this a long time ago. I'm going to butcher it. But they like used neural nets to create every melody in a certain segment of time, and then went to the court and like copyrighted it just to like prove the point.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if that like has ever stood up in a case, but I did see that as well. It's kind of interesting. Let's talk about Unreal for a bit. I'm curious on that. I just got into Resolume recently, and my friend Funi, who does all my artwork, made like a bunch of 5 or 10 second clips, so I started using Resolume to sequence them to build out a visual show. Are you using Unreal specifically to try and make visuals for your live show, or are you just find it interesting, or
both? It's the primary function for me of learning and devoting time to it is to incorporate it into the show, for sure. I think that in general, it's interesting to see how you would go about like creating a 3D environment, and like it's almost like you have to like follow physics and like follow all of these like natural occurring parameters in order to like photorealistically recreate environments or scenarios. Specifically, once you get into like the concept of like exporting it, like putting the camera in the space and setting the camera settings and all of that. But Unreal in general, I think, is just so incredibly powerful. And I think we're getting to a point certainly where it's going to be pretty hard to, if done correctly, like determine whether or not it's real or fake.
Yeah, especially in conjunction with stuff like Sora. Like, if that gets integrated into Unreal and can just like do half of the stuff for you, then yeah.
Well, I mean, if Sora gets good enough, it kind of like obsoletes Unreal in some way. If you can be specific and constant with the parameters in Sora, it's like, if you could get like, I think, I forget which one just did it. I think it was Midjourney or something, but they have like character recreation now, so you can like kind of like flag or bench a character and then like reuse that character in different environments. And I think once Sora gets there, it's going to disrupt like the entire film industry. You know, it's going to be a huge change.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've always found a little finicky about the text prompted stuff, is the only parameter is writing text in a box. Like, for instance, there's a couple that I use with music, and you'll put in, like, I don't know, dark techno track, 128 BPM, Jasaffel Stein or something. And every time you hit it, it will output something completely different that is maybe close or maybe not close to what you had imagined or what you want or what you're going to find useful. And so I feel like what would make those things more useful is like checkboxes or something, like a, you know, a bunch of checkboxes for genre, a bunch of checkboxes for BPM, or, you know, some parameter sliders for like intensity and creativity and, you know, monotonality versus polytonality, mono, you know, versus polyrhythms and stuff like that. And yeah, I feel like we really need those kind of parameters to get closer to the outputs we actually want. And yeah, I think as soon as we have that and the AI becomes powerful enough, then yeah, we'll disrupt a lot of industry stuff, especially even music. I think in terms of, you know, like writing jingles for an ad or like writing, you know, stock music for a YouTube video or for a, you know, maybe music for a game or something. I think like there will always be room for humans to do music because we're all inherently on Team Human and we like to see humans do things, you know, like for instance in chess, you can watch two chess engines that are more powerful than the two most powerful grandmasters on the earth play chess against each other. And some people do for learning purposes, but we still hold chess tournaments where we pay the winner $1 million for winning because it's just impressive to watch a human do it.
Yeah, have you seen like the AlphaGo stuff?
Mm-hmm, with, yeah.
Yeah, I found that one to be like very interesting. It's like the Google, I think it's like DeepMind or something is the name of the program or whatever, but it beat the world's like leading Go player, and I think he retired afterwards, and I thought that was kind of strange.
Yeah, but I guarantee you there's still Go tournaments happening like every day that people are going to watch, even though we could, in theory, just watch a perfect game of Go played every single time if we wanted by a computer. It just, for some reason, is not interesting to us to do that. It just feels stale to watch. It's not as exciting.
Yeah, there seems to be something about like watching a human kind of like push the limits or, you know, excel at whatever it is that they're doing, whether that's like a sport game or a guitar player or chess player.
I think part of it is the ability for it to fuck up, you know, like if you're watching an AI, you know, it's never going to fuck up, or you assume it's never going to. It's just not exciting. You're just like, yeah, it's doing the thing perfectly, whatever. But like if you're watching somebody, you know, play an instrument on stage and they're like riding the edge of fucking it up, basically, or like maybe they're not, maybe they're doing it flawlessly, but like just the possibility that it could go completely wrong is, I think, part of what makes it impressive to watch. Especially with sports, right? Like gymnastics, people are doing like crazy flips and shit. You're like, man, they could just like break all of their bones at any time. This is crazy. Whereas if you're watching a robot do the same thing and you've watched and you know for sure that this robot's going to nail it, like, yeah, it'd be impressive to watch, but it also, I don't know, there's not that like element of sort of surprise as much, maybe.
Yeah, tying that back into like music, you know, working in a digital audio workstation, things are effectively like inherently perfect. Like when you strike the thing, it will happen. Like when you arm the track, it will record audio. There's like rules. How do you go about like maybe recreating that in digital audio workstations or trying to get closer to that like imperfection?
Well, I've never really thought about it this way, but personally, I quite often, when I'm doing sound design, will sort of set up a system where the sound will just kind of do random things and I'll record it down and then I'll end up with some long, you know, 20-minute file of sort of random weird noise that I will then go when I'm making music and cut bits out of it to put into my song. I call these mud pies. And to me, that's a little bit like that, right? It's like it's exciting to me to do it because I don't know what's going to happen in the synth. It could make a crazy distorted sound, or it could all of a sudden start doing some lush melody, or, you know, in the most idealistic sense, that's what would happen. And to me, that's surprising and fun. And then by then taking those kind of mistakes out and putting them into my music, it kind of, I think, imparts that imperfect sort of random, surprising vibe to it a little bit. At least for me, it does, I think, even though I've never really thought about it that way, and that's not really why I do it. I more so do it for like a workflow thing. It's just faster than to make, you know, 100 completely different sounds. It's faster to just make a bunch of random ones and then just pick them. But I think that in a way, that is a way of recreating that kind of randomness, or that element of stuff just accidentally fucking up into music. Do you do similar things, or how would you think about that?
I think like I'm the same as you. I don't necessarily actively think about it. Like, I think it just sometimes happens. And that's why I really like Eurorack stuff. Like Eurorack stuff, there's something about having electricity go through something and like a circuit, as opposed to a computer, which is like calculating something. You know, there's something about Eurorack stuff where it's like, even if you just like leave the synth on for so long, like the oscillators drift apart, and like there's things like that that create these natural imperfections that are highly appealing.
Yeah, I agree. I think, yeah, if everything is too perfect, it's not fun. But having said that, the AI audio generators that I've messed around with, like the one by Stability AI or Stable Audio, I can't remember what the company's called, that can just generate songs, I find interesting for a similar reason, because I don't know what's going to happen. It's like you type in a thing and you hit go, and it's like a little surprise song comes out the other end. Maybe it sucks, maybe it doesn't, but I'm still like, it's like crack. I'm like using it constantly to just generate stuff because I'm like, what's going to happen? You know, it's like exciting.
So yeah, like on the topic of like input devices and all of that, like when you go into this thing and type in like lo-fi, jazz, whatever, and it creates a song, like what is really different about that input as opposed to, you know, mouse and keyboard or all of that? I mean, there's different levels of expression, obviously, instrumentation, all of that. But at the end of the day, like, are you still, you're still just like creating this thing based on, you know, the formula parameter of like whatever it is, whatever system, like stable audio, stable diffusion or whatever it is that's pumping it out. Do you really feel like less responsible for the creation when you do it that way?
I do, yeah. And I think the reason why is because, well, it's kind of too, yeah, I feel like it's important to feel a sense of ownership over a piece of music. And I feel like that sense of ownership comes from effort and time, because I guess like time is our only finite resource. And the more that you spend that on something, the more highly that you personally value it as being a thing that has like, you know, special value to you because you spend that time on it. Whereas, you know, same thing will happen if like somebody sends me a tune for a collab or whatever, and I don't like a few of the things that they did, and I'm like, oh, I want to remove this and that and that. They'll be like, no, don't, because they spend so much time on it, you know. And even if it's like objectively doesn't need to be in the song or whatever, I do the same thing. Like if I spend a lot of time on something in a piece of music, I have a harder time deleting it than if I just dragged a sample in that just didn't work. I have a very easy time deleting that, for instance. And I feel like the same is true for these AI outputs. It's like, this thing took me like 2 seconds to make. I didn't have a lot to do with it. Like, it wasn't maybe trained on my stuff. I don't know what it was trained on. I didn't really think that hard about the prompt, all this kind of stuff. Like, it just doesn't elicit that same feeling of ownership or, I guess, sentimental value. Maybe would it be sentimental? I don't know.
Yeah, to me, it's like word choice of like ownership, I think to me, like if anything, ownership would just be when there is a natural or something that's like an expression of what I'm feeling or what I'm going through or what I'm trying to accomplish. I think as long as that feels genuine and is like on the screen and I can hear it, I don't think I care as much like how I got there.
So you think you would be happy typing words into an AI, having it generate something and just releasing that?
If it was a genuine expression of what I was feeling and I was able to say that like authentically, I don't think it's there, but I think that if that was the case, I think that would be a huge time saver. Like, I don't actually necessarily enjoy the process of creating music. Like I used to, and I think like I maybe have perhaps become like jaded over the years of just doing it for so long, but now if it almost feels like a chore to some degree, and that changes like when I find something new that's like inspiring or some new tool or technology or whatever it is. But if I could type words into a box and have it authentically recreate what I'm feeling and be unique and feel like it was like an expression of myself, I would absolutely choose that way.
And what do you think would be the defining factors of what made you feel like it was what you were feeling and all of that?
Well, it's hard to say because it's like feelings are, I feel like emotions and music are very hard to translate into like the domain of speech. And that's like why it's music. It's because it's like there's a feeling you get with repetition or melody or certain things. Like I very much like to, I do like five fifth scale degree, second scale degree, and third scale degree melodies, like pretty much in all of my songs. Like there's like a motif that's like circulating over different chord progressions, which just like rubs different ways and all of that. And I think like there's just motifs that like I've incorporated into most of my music that seem to show up naturally. And so it's hard to define or like put an objective definition on it or any sort of term. I think more than anything, it's a feeling.
So on any given day, like let's say today you're feeling a certain way, you have a certain type piece of music in your mind that's going to elicit that feeling. Does anything in your past catalog already do that?
Oh man, that's hard. Yeah. I think, typically I'm probably not sitting down with the intention of being emotive. Like I'm sitting down as like a, almost like a symbiotic experience with the thing. Like I want to interact with the computer or interact with an instrument in a way where that thing shows me something that then I get inspired by. So I don't really know how to answer that question. I think, it's not just like a one-way feed. It's not just like my brain has an idea which is triggering, you know, electrical impulses in my muscles to interact with the thing that then goes into the computer. I think there it's a loop. It's like a interactive symbiotic thing that I'm like engaging with. Like I'm trying to build something with the machine, if you will.
Okay, so it is more about the process than about the final product.
Well, it's hard because sometimes like the final product shows up on the screen in 5 minutes. You know, sometimes it's there in 10 minutes. Like the loop that felt right or whatever it is shows up immediately. Sometimes it takes weeks or months. And I think ultimately I haven't been able to find a consistent way to like pump out that to get there. I haven't really been able to find that. I think some days, like I'm a very throw paint at the wall and see what sticks kind of guy. Like, and I think like in getting inspired with it, I'll maybe know a direction or like a route or a pathway I can take that might get me there quicker. And I think like a lot of my catalog probably does have very, it has, I try to make like a lot of different type of stuff. I try to not be a genre guy or whatever. I try to just like not have so much attachment and just kind of like work with the thing until it's done. But I do think like a lot of my catalog has a very similar feel or like emotion perhaps underlying it. And that could be related specifically to like the motifs that I use often.
Yeah. So I wonder like what the chances are that that any AI, even if it was trained specifically just on all of your music, would actually output something that hits that kind of small Venn diagram of like your ideals and how you're feeling on any given day. It seems like a small target to hit for something that's kind of just like randomly outputting things, even if it were trained on your own thing. And that's been my experience with it so far, is like I'll have an idea in mind, but the chances that it like just nails that idea perfectly is just so small. And I feel like I'm so picky with music in general, but then on any given day I'm like extremely picky about like very specific things in the music, and it's always different as to what that thing is. So my experience has been, even if I'm able to output something and I think like, oh, that's pretty sick, just because of like how I am with music, I'll just sit there and change it for like a week anyway.
So I'm the opposite there. Like I try to not, like typically for me, if whatever sound or atmosphere or operator or whatever it is that I'm working on to try to like fit into the piece or whatever, it's usually like five minutes. If that thing is not gelled in or working, it's like deleted and I move on. I try to not get attached to like any direction or particular thing. And in general, like I'm not really interested in like twisting knobs so much. I do a lot of like audio resampling and just things like that, and like stumbling on something that did inspire me or did work or did like kind of like express what I was going for, and then just playing off that or working with that instead. And I think like it gets complicated too. Like we actually like played a few shows together like a couple years ago on the Immersive Tour, and you asked me, you said like, how many holes do humans have or something like that. You like asked
I remember this. I asked you, how many holes do a pair of pants have?
Okay, yeah. So like that actually got me like super interested in like ontology in general and just like the study of things and like how humans categorize things. And so it's like, I feel like if my brain, for example, isn't capable of making meaningful categorizations into like all the domains or dimensions like necessary to explain to you what like authentic expression of myself is, like I can't do that through language. And maybe like AI could, maybe AI is capable of like categorizing and like making these like smaller and smaller categories enough to where it is capable of doing that, which is where I see, I guess, like the potential of large language models or typing text into a box and having it convert that.
Yeah, I don't know if it would come through text in a box. Like you said, words don't quite abstract like the emotions properly anyway. So what would it be, like a bunch of slider parameters, a bunch of checkboxes, or a Neuralink? Hard to say.
Yeah, it's tricky because like if you break language down into just symbols, and which is abstract in itself, like it's completely arbitrary, I think, like what we associate meaning to like each individual symbol to be. So there could certainly be like a limitation with text and the ability to like express things musically.
Yeah, interesting stuff. By the way, how many holes do pants have, in your opinion?
Define hole.
Yeah, that's also kind of where I go with it. It's like, if I just dig a small like ditch in a ground, is that a hole? Or when does it become a hole? Like if I dig it 10 meters down, if I just dig 1 centimeter down, or if I, does it have to have an exit out the other end? You know?
Yeah, it's, I like the other one too. It's like, what is a chair? Like a chair is actually like incredibly complex. Like if you really break down like what it is, like if I take away the armrests, is it still a chair? If I take away the back, is it still a chair? Like how much of the chair do I have to take away from the chair before it's not a chair anymore?
Right, because you could just sit on the ground still.
And I think like the best probable thing, like at least like in the domain of ontology, I think like, there's the concept of like simples, like breaking things down to their fundamental parts, like the atomic structure of them, makes the most sense to me on paper.
Yeah, I mean, I heard this joke once, which was anything is a dildo if you're brave enough. And I feel like same goes for chairs. Anything's a chair if you're brave enough.
But yeah, how many holes do pants have? It's like a hole, I think, like by probably the Webster's definition, is like you're trying to define the absence of something, like to start, which is hard, difficult.
Yeah, I think topologists will always say two, because if you like take a pair of pants and you compress them down onto the ground, there's like two holes, basically one for each leg, right? But yeah, hard to say exactly. Well, hey man, I got to get back to work, but I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today. I think a lot of people will find this chat interesting. And where can people find you, and what do you got going on? Like, where should people go see you play if you're playing shows?
I'm just super task on all socials and stuff. Got the Unts Festival coming up, few things this summer, but mostly I'm just gonna be doing some stuff on the internet, a bunch of music releases and stuff like that, and trying to focus a little more on YouTube and putting out some like music videos and some visual pieces there.
Hell yeah, yeah, I'm stoked to see what you do with those now that you're using Unreal.
Sweet. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, cheers, man. Thanks for listening to the Mr. Bill podcast. Credit to Robert Fumo for the production and edit. Join MrBillsTunes.com for early access to the video podcast, tutorials, sample packs, and more. And please consider rating and reviewing us on all pod thingies, because it really helps the podcast.